With the first reading, I'm going to teach you a new word for many of you. Those of you who do crossword puzzles will probably thank me. The word is pericope. And what that means in New Testament critical language is a singular gospel story from the New Testament. But in this case, it's a free-floating, totally anonymous pericope, which is not found in any of the ancient manuscripts of the four Gospels. In our era, it's found in the Gospel of John, but it was inserted there by some unknown scribe around the 4th century. It may have been written down as late as the year 200, or it may have been written as early as the year 100, but more than that, we simply can't guess from internal textual evidence. The evidence, however, does suggest that the authors of the Gospel of John had nothing to do with it. This translation of the Greek text makes the legal language very explicit. Listen for it. In the early morning, he came again to the temple precincts. There, he sat down, as teachers usually do, and he began to teach. Some local scribal authorities and rigorous religious leaders then approached him. They were dragging a woman with them, whom they charged with the crime of adultery. Thrusting her into the midst of the gathered students, their spokesman said, "Teacher, the evidence is quite clear. This woman has committed adultery. Our law clearly lays down the punishment for such a crime. Death by stoning. What's your opinion in this matter?" They asked him this question to see if they could put him in a bind or even expose some legal charge against him. But Jesus only bent over and started to record something using his finger to write in the earth at his feet. When he ignored them, they pressed him all the more to answer their question. So then he stood up and he said to them, "Why not ask the innocent among you to cast the first stone?" And then immediately he sat back down again and he bent over and continued to write in the earth as if recording something. But after hearing what he had to say, one by one, the men simply went away, the oldest among them leaving first. Even his students left, leaving Jesus alone with the woman standing there before him. So he looked up at her and said, "Madam, where has everyone gone? Is no one pressing sentence against you?" "No one, sir," she answered. "Well, I'm not passing sentence either. So go your way now, and be careful not to make that mistake again." The second reading is a remarkable poem by the Colorado activist Laura Hershey, with a truly amazing track record in social justice issues ranging from GLBT issues and disability issues, the second of which I think you'll here in the poem. This is a poem I wish I had written, and I think many of you will probably ask me for a copy of it afterward. At least I would wager that.
You get proud by practicing. If you are not proud for who you are, for what you say, for how you look, if every time you stop to think of yourself, you do not see yourself glowing with golden light, do not, therefore, give up on yourself. You can get proud.
You do not need a better body, a pure spirit, or a PhD to get proud. You do not need a lot of money, a handsome boyfriend, or a nice car. You do not need to be able to walk, to see, or hear, or use big complicated words or do any of the things you just can't do to be proud. A caseworker cannot make you proud, or a doctor. You only need more practice. You get proud by practicing.
There are many ways to get proud. You can try riding a horse, or skiing on one leg, or playing a guitar, and do well, or not so well. Be glad you tried either way.
You can show something you've made to someone you respect and be happy with it no matter what they say. You can say what you think, though you know other people may not think the same way, and you can keep saying it, even if they tell you you are crazy.
You can add your voice all night to the 150 others at a jailhouse where your brothers and sisters are being held for blocking buses with no lift. Or you can be one of the ones inside the jailhouse, knowing of the circle outside.
You can speak your love to a friend without fear. You can find someone who will listen to you without judging you or doubting you or being afraid of you, and let you hear yourself, perhaps, for the first time.
These are all ways of getting proud. None of them are easy, but all of them are possible. You can do all of these things, or just one of them, again and again. You get proud by practicing.
Power makes you proud, and power comes in many fine forms, supple and rich as butterfly wings. It is music when you practice opening your mouth and liking what you hear because it is the sound of your one true voice.
It is sunlight when you practice seeing strength and beauty in everyone, including yourself. It is dance when you practice knowing that what you do and the way you do it is the right way for you and can't be called wrong.
All of these hold more power than weapons or money or lies. All these practices bring power, and power makes you proud. You get proud by practicing.
Remember, you weren't the one who made you ashamed, but you are the one who can make you proud. Just practice, practice, until you get proud. And once you are proud, keep practicing so you won't forget. You get proud by practicing.
Thank you.
I don't know about you, but I've begun to wonder how anyone ever understood modern culture here in the United States before the invention of the ice cube tray. You know, those little oblong things in our freezers, before our freezers got so techno-savvy with their automatic ice makers and all that. I'm talking about the old-fashioned ice cube trays, the ones made of metal originally and now more likely plastic, the ones with 16 ice cubes paired in two neat side-by-side rows. I say this because for me, the ice cube tray is a perfect picture of the cultural system of metaphors that we use here in the United States. For instance, we speak of black or white people as if the 600 real colors of everyone else in the world didn't actually exist, or as if black and white were actually descriptive, which they indeed are not. We speak of male and female as if they were two rigid categories, although any anthropologist of human culture, or a physician or a biologist, can tell you that gender is 100 times more complicated than that. We speak politically of being either on the left or on the right. We speak of gay or straight, old or young, introvert or extrovert, theist or atheist, believer or unbeliever, love or hate, compassion or justice, guilt or innocence. There you have it. The ice cube tray theory of North American culture, two by two by two by two by two by two by two, frozen solid. However, 31 years in ministry and 60 years of living have inspired in me a desire to thaw the ice cube tray, to melt the metaphors a bit, to let things flow a little, questioning the easy definitions and trying to get clearer about others. Take justice, for example, January's theme word. So many things get in the way of any really easy definition of that frequently used word. First, I'm aware that I don't want to confuse the word justice with the word fairness, which indeed is often done. Now, it may not seem fair to us that some people die at age 22 and others live to a ripe old 102, but this state of affairs is not what I mean by justice, unless you have the rather cold theological opinion that the actual date of one's death is somehow the judgment of an arbitrary God. Unequal length of life doesn't strike most of us as fair, but it really isn't unjust. Although, and here's where things get complicated, there are elements of justice involved in some length of life issues. For example, if a destitute 60-year-old woman will not be able to thrive for another 10 years because she can't afford the best medical care to treat her specific illness, an illness that is indeed usually curable, but somebody else with that same illness can because they're privileged with sufficient means, then justice does at least interface with fairness, but really they're not quite the same thing. Second, the Chinese story that we heard earlier about the pear seed points to another complexity involved in getting clear about the meaning of justice. Although the ice cube theory of guilt and innocence implies that a person is either guilty or innocent, the story suggests that guilt and innocence are mixed up in every person, both the poor woman who stole in order to survive and the judges that sought to punish her for her crime. Justice and innocence, says the story, are not a couple of frozen ice cubes totally separated from each other. they kind of melt together in human beings. Why? Because there is always some larger context overarching any particular justice story, a context that burns hot like a sun. The story of the first reading, the free-floating pericope, and for many, a very well-known story of the teacher and the woman, and what has been described by one theologian as a lynch mob, suggests to me where I might look for such a context, such a sun, to start the melting process in other areas. Now, as you well know, there are many, many ways to interpret stories. You can bring many personal points of view to the understanding of any tale. When I first read this story, it was easy to see it simply as a tale of a bunch of arrogant and sexist men making cruel decisions about a woman as if she wasn't even there to speak for herself. This might be called a feminist reading by European-rooted thinkers, or in African-American theological terms, a womanist interpretation. Or you could give this story a nice postmodern reading, namely, this story reveals that these punitive laws about our private sexual lives proves that religion is wicked and should be ripped off the face of the earth once and for all. Then there is the anti-Jewish variant reading, namely, that this story of the potential stoning proves, once and for all, that the Old Testament God of strict law and order is so much more nasty than the New Testament God of sweetness and light. But I have most often found out that that's the opinion, usually, of people who like to cherry-pick their way into the standard bigotries of the Western world, which they were steeped in from the beginning of their lives, and with which they are not even, aware themselves that they're being steeped in it. There is also what might be called the literate reading of the story. It's a tale with a witty and surprising comeback line, a story of verbal comeuppance, if you will, what folklorists like to call a wisdom tale. Here, however, is the historical context of the story. Here is the first ray of hot sunlight to start melting things together. Although it's true we don't know who wrote the story, the author did have historical sensitivity, suggesting a complete familiarity with the precise political situation in which Jesus lived. In the year 30, the Roman occupation government officially stripped the Jewish court system of all of its authority and put Judea under Roman law. No religious judge from that time on had the right to impose any sentence on anyone without first taking it through the Roman magistrate. Now, the Jewish law system prescribed capital punishment in a variety of cases which were deemed disruptive to the larger social order. Murder, certainly, but adultery was taken very seriously too. Both parties, male and female, equally, were tried and then taken out to a quarry. The witnesses of the crime, the accusers themselves, threw the first stones, and then anyone who had experienced the sad result of adultery in their own family lives were invited to throw stones, and so on and so forth. By making this a community execution, there could be no clarity as to which stone struck the fatal blow, and thus there could be no vendettas or tit-for-tat blood revenge, as is often common in many societies. You can see that such a practice, although undeniably horrific, was sociologically different from the state-sponsored murder, which we call capital punishment, favored by Rome, or by the state of Ohio, for that matter. The story, as we have it, is filled to the brim with legal language, such as to pass sentence, evidence, crime, innocence. Even the odd image of Jesus bending over and writing with his finger on the ground uses the Greek verb katagraphein, which means to record, recording something, even as in our own day, something is recorded by a court recorder. Now, here's the issue. If the teacher had offered an opinion in favor of the Jewish court practice, that is, capital punishment is the law of the land, then a lynching would have taken place. But then Jesus himself would have been immediately arrested for preaching against Roman legal sovereignty. But if he had said, "Oh, just follow the Roman law, they're in charge, you know, they have the army," his students would have immediately lost faith in his authority as a Jewish teacher. Why? Because he could be seen to be clearly favoring Caesar over Moses. And this effectively would have sabotaged his entire future teaching career. Either way, the religious elders figured, he was out of the picture. And please, don't go thinking of these religious leaders as cads and monsters either. The storyteller in no way paints them as villains. The loss of their capacity to practice their interpretation of their own law, to practice their own culture, however I might disagree with the idea of stoning anybody for any reason, must have been deeply painful and disorienting to them. They were losing their sense of identity, and that's always deeply painful. And I can understand a desperate impulse to try to preserve it, especially when there is a teacher going around questioning some of the aspects of the Torah. Being occupied by a foreign military presence with imposed laws, imposed customs, and assumptions is never a picnic. There are probably people in this world right now who could tell you what it feels like if you could find a way to ask them. No, Jesus's looser interpretation of the law at other times, made him scary to many people, and I don't blame them for being scared. So the context of the story, you see, is very complex, and easy judgments on a first reading are probably not very accurate. The core of the story, as I read it, however, is neither about the context nor about the defense of cultural identity. The core of the story is the teacher's clever way of getting himself and the woman out of a jam. He doesn't criticize the law or their interpretation of it. He simply invites the innocent among them to cast the first stone. He actually treats them as honest, self-reflective peers, not his bitter enemies. He is trusting them to realize that guilt and innocence are not neat ice cube categories. He does not force a clean separation between guilt and innocence, or for that matter, between his compassion for the woman's plight and the demands for justice under the law. He asks each of them to make an honest assessment of their own lives and ask them how different they are from the poor woman they are using as a political symbol. And so one by one, self-reflective as they are, they drop their rocks and they drop their charges, leaving the teacher alone with the woman. "Is no one pressing charges?" he asks. "No one, sir," she answers. "Well, I'm not pressing charges either," he says, and then he warns her not to make that mistake again. "No, not sin." Sorry, the King James Version, as is usual, is wrong about most everything. The Greek word hamartain simply means to make a mistake. I have a friend who's made a couple of mistakes, made them a long time ago when he was 17. He got in with what my parents used to call a bad crowd. Ever hear that phrase before, a bad crowd? He was charged with committing two crimes within a three-month period. They were felonies, according to Ohio law. He served time for these felonies, about a year. But since that time, he has made his own way pretty well. He got his GED all on his own. He's taking classes at Columbus State. He pays child support for his beloved daughter and throws her nifty birthday parties. He pays his rent, mostly on time, if he's got work. And he has become a pro bodybuilder, requiring the kind of almost scary discipline that's entirely foreign to me. He's been a good friend to me for the last 10 years, and he would never think of turning down Thanksgiving dinner at my house because, after all, he's family. Whenever he gets a job interview, he just had one at a large local company. They loved his work, they loved his personality, they loved his initiative. They always eventually have to turn him down because their computer check lifts up the felonies on his record from 15 years ago. One of which he claims, one of the two felonies he claims, and I believe him, was a setup in the first place, a mistake. He freely admits breaking the law the other time. It was, like the woman in the Chinese story, a form of theft. But since there are officially two felonies on his record, both dating from the very time in our lives when many of us make mistakes as part of our growing up process, he cannot have them expunged from his record. Despite his exemplary life since then, the law, Ohio law, makes that entirely clear. Give $1,000 and one felony can be removed from your record. If you have two, too bad. You are tattooed for life with your past mistakes. In other words, he has a life sentence. Oh, he tried to get it expunged. I lent him the money to pursue that option. He tried very hard. He went to court. The judge looked at him and admitted that the law was a bad one, but that there was nothing he could do. My friend came back from Springfield and said to me, "Mark, I give up. I give up." But you know, he really hasn't given up. Right now, he's working with a few friends. Call them a good crowd. He's working with a few friends to open up a gym down at the Seneca Building on Broad Street, a training gym. They have more money to invest than he does, but my friend has been working hard to paint and build walls and do the things he can do in that site very well. He has pride in what he does. He has pride in what he has done these last 15 years, despite his life sentence. And sorry, although the medieval theologians thought of pride as one of the seven deadly sins, right now I don't see it that way. Except when it's a delusional kind of pride. In fact, I see the kind of pride that Jimmy has about his athletic ability, his work skills, his GED, his initiative, despite everything that has pulled him back, as his safe pathway between the frozen definitions of justice and compassion that wall him in and have permanently damaged his life. Ohio law permits, you see, no compassion for someone with his record. Unlike the record Jesus was making with his finger in the dirt, my friend's record will never blow away in the breeze or melt away in the rain. And though I know his situation intimately and have compassion for his plight and am his friend, that love cannot magically rewrite Ohio law and change the world of his reality. So what saves my friend is his sacred pride. And as far as I can tell, he practices that pride each and every day, because you get proud by practicing, says poet Laura Hershey. If you are not proud for who you are, for what you say, for how you look, if every time you stop to think of yourself, you do not see yourself glowing with golden light, do not, therefore, give up on yourself. You can get proud. Poet Hershey lists many ways of getting proud and then finally says, power makes you proud. It is music when you practice opening your mouth and liking what you hear because it is the sound of your one true voice. It is sunlight when you practice seeing strength and beauty in everyone, including yourself. It is dance when you practice knowing that what you do and the way you do it is right for you and can't be called wrong. All of these hold more power than weapons or money or lies. All these practices bring power, and power makes you proud. You get proud by practicing. Remember, you weren't the one who made you ashamed, but you are the one who can make you proud. Just practice, and practice until you get proud. And once you are proud, keep practicing so you won't forget, because you get proud by practicing. Oh, I wish I had written that. I intend to read it to myself every day for a good long time. I intend to give it to my friend so he can read it every day, and to my son. For me, Hershey's poem does to my heart what Jesus' famous words in the story did to my heart the first time that I heard them. They melted the icy barrier separating justice and compassion into conflicting worlds. For me, compassion and justice are not at odds. It is never a matter of either compassion or justice anymore, as Dom Crossan says, than there can be a matter of a coin with only one side. So for me, justice has to do, and here comes the definition, with equal access to power. And compassion has to do with equal access to pride. Together, they sow the seeds for a new life on earth, for my friend, for that poor ancient woman, a life of justice deeper than the written law that cannot be easily changed, a life of compassion deeper than mere sympathy, a partnership that can resist the frozen obstacles of an ice cube tray civilization and get on with establishing a growing human covenant of trust and honesty, peace and justice and love here on this earth. Let the sun that melts the ice continue to shine throughout every one of our New Year days.